I thought I knew a lot about the Roebling Suspension Bridge, and maybe you do too. Construction was suspended during the Civil War. It was the first bridge linking the North to the South when it opened in 1867, and it served as a prototype for Roebling's Brooklyn Bridge. But Richard Hawes's new book, Engineering America, The Life and Times of John A. Roebling, taught me a lot about the challenges Roebling overcame to build Cincinnati's beloved icon. Haw, a professor at the City University of New York, joins me by Zoom tonight to talk about his new book. Richard, welcome to Around Cincinnati.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
So most Cincinnati knows that the suspension bridge was started before the Civil War. But from your book, I learned that the legislation to build the bridge actually goes all the way back to 1846, right?
Yes. The plans or the proposals to bridge the Ohio River between Cincinnati and Covington date back to about 1815. And there are tons of different proposals from about 1815 up to the early 1840s. John Roebling in nearby Pittsburgh opens his second suspension bridge in early 1846. And it sort of picked up in the Kentucky press and in the Cincinnati press, where this issue of the bridge has been really important for several years. Because it's a bridge that connects two states, legislation has to be passed in both the Kentucky legislature and the Ohio legislature. Legislation is introduced in, I think, February 1846, around the same time as John Roebling finishes his second suspension bridge and comes to Cincinnati to start conducting surveys. And so legislation is first passed in Kentucky, but it's incredibly controversial. The most controversial part of it concerns enslaved people.
The slave clause, right?
Yeah, the slave clause. And so there's two sort of aspects to it, one of which is the bridge as a private company will not allow any enslaved or Black Americans to cross the bridge unless there is direct written assent by their owners. But also the second and controversial, the really controversial part of this is that it makes the bridge company themselves, the private company that owns the bridge, liable for any escaped slaves. So any documented escaped slaves that are documented to have gone over the bridge into Ohio, the bridge company themselves become liable for reimbursing the slave owners for that. And that's something that Cincinnati just can't really countenance.
The construction was delayed because of the war, and we know the war was about slavery, but it didn't strike me until I read your book about that cultural issue that divided America was really at the core of one of the issues of trying to build this bridge to bridge the Ohio River.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about Kentucky in the 19th century because it's not really a plantation state, and it's neutral in the Civil War, but it is a slave state. It makes a lot of its money on, awful as it is to say, on breeding and selling slaves and selling them down to southern plantations. So the issue of escaped slaves in Kentucky is a huge issue, specifically in the sort of state capital and in Lexington and other large cities in the state, whereas it's much less important in Covington. So effectively, Covington really wants a bridge because it wants to link itself to Cincinnati, which is a hugely important city in 19th century America, whereas much of the rest of the state is more sort of orientated south in its economy. So legislatures are much more interested in protecting slaves and slave owners than joining Cincinnati's economic booms. And of course, Covington's just at that time a very small little part of the tip of Kentucky, so it doesn't have as much say. So they really want a bridge, but Kentucky is much more leery. And the Ohio River is a hugely important issue in the history of American race relations and slavery. It's a major stop of the Underground Railroad. Ohio itself, and Cincinnati especially, is full of abolitionists. And so it's a really fraught issue between the two states. And the Ohio River itself is a really fraught boundary between the North and the South.
Another issue was it because of the way the river bends through the Cincinnati-Covington area. Wasn't there a concern that you needed a center pier in the bridge to either bridge the span or to get enough elevation so steamboats could go under it?
So in 1846, there are two issues that sort of plague getting the bridge project up and running. And one is the issue of slavery and freedom. And the other is the issue that Cincinnati is really a port town. It's also a period in American history where the railroads are coming. And so it's really a battle between how are you going to move things around and where's commerce going to come from? Is it going to come from your rivers or is it going to come from railroads? And it's sort of a point in American history where that issue is not quite decided. Railroads, we know, go on to sort of win and become the dominant means of transporting things around the U.S. But at that point, there's a real battle between overland traffic or you're going to have river traffic. And the problem in erecting almost all suspension bridges in the 19th century is this issue of navigation. It's the same problem that really plagues building the Brooklyn Bridge, because New York, likewise, is a port city, and it makes most of its money by river traffic. And so any sort of impediment in the river scares the bejesus out of anyone who owns a steamboat or conducts business on the river. They think it'll ruin their livelihood. And so when John Roebling comes to Cincinnati in 1846, he comes up with a plan, which we wouldn't really recognize as a suspension bridge nowadays, with sort of a central pier. So instead of having two big towers and the sweep of the cables going between them, you have two much shorter abutment towers on either side, and then a great big 200-foot tall tower right in the middle of the Ohio River, which John came up with hoping to have less impediment on the sides of the river so as not to really get in the way of the port or the harbor traffic there. But it did not breed confidence. Certainly in a city where river traffic is so important, sticking a great big hulking tower right in the middle of the Ohio River does not look like a good plan.
Was that also a Y bridge, that it would both connect Newport and Covington?
That was not his thoughts. I mean, I hope for all your people out there in Ohio know of the Zanesville Bridge, the Y Bridge. John didn't propose it, but there was a number of really interesting proposals. A lot of them are in the book in the early 19th century about how to link, because it's not just two towns. It's really three towns, as you say. Because then if you do that, you can sort of link both Covington and Newport and get rid of the Licking River, which is sort of in between those two towns at the time. But there was a proposal to have a central road come out from Cincinnati, then branch off in a sort of Y shape, one to Covington and one to Newport. Most of these plans are sort of arch bridges, stone arch bridges, which is what the technology is at the time. Suspension bridges are very new. And one of the ways in which John is hugely important is at the beginning of the 19th century, most suspension bridges fall down. At the end of the 19th century, most of them stay up. And John is a key figure in working out how suspension bridges work and why they do stay up.
Just right before the Ohio River Bridge was started, there was a suspension bridge between Newport and Covington. And what, that fell down in 2 weeks or something?
Yeah, it was terribly, terribly, terribly designed. Suspension bridges are hard to build. You know, you think about the early 19th century, there's no computers. Everything's built by hand. Everything's worked out on a notepad. There is a lot of complicated mathematics and metallurgy in a suspension bridge. Stress, how much stress metals can take. Work out load span ratios. There's loads of sort of things that you need to know to build a suspension bridge well and correctly. I mean, as an example, aerodynamic pressure on a bridge, wind, usually gales. And that really wasn't worked out until complex computer modeling in the 20th century. And so a lot of bridges that were built were sort of almost on a wing and a prayer. And certainly the Licking Bridge, I think, was built in 1854, and it lasted, I think, 2 or 3 weeks until someone drove a whole bunch of cows over it and it just collapsed. And I think I probably don't know the exact numbers, but it needed to be able to take something like 700 tons worth of pressure, and it could only take about 100. It was just really badly designed.
The first suspension bridge, I think it said in your book, was the Louisville and Frankfort Railroad over the Kentucky River, and that one only lasted about 5 years. So this was really new technology that he was trying to perfect.
It was. Railroad suspension bridges, they don't really work. The only person that's actually managed to build a fully functional railroad suspension bridge is John Roebling up at Niagara, and that lasted for about 40 years. It really worked well. What you really want for a railroad suspension bridge is a truss bridge, because you really need that stability and strength. Suspension bridges are built to be sort of flexible to account for a moving load and not to be quite as rigid as a truss bridge. So, yeah, I mean, the problems that affected railroad suspension bridges affected suspension bridges all over the world in the early 19th century. And I say, John was really a key figure in making all that stuff work and working out all the various components of a bridge and how they needed to function together to create a strong, rigid enough bridge that would span long distances, resist gale force winds, all these sort of things, because you can only be so flexible before you start to have things like gales play on you.
So when it was completed in 1867, how was it received by engineers and designers? I mean, was it thought to be a modern marvel?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So it was on the front page of every newspaper in the country. The best sort of visual representations of things in the 19th century, all through those wonderful 19th century illustrated magazines like Harper's and Frank Leslie's and Scientific American, it was on the front cover of all of those. Images of it were reproduced all around the world. John was really very famous at this time anyway, and this just really was further evidence. Frank Leslie called him clearly one of the most important engineers in the 19th century. And it sort of cemented his reputation. And the really interesting sort of historical fact about that is 3 weeks after the Cincinnati Bridge is opened, the East River in New York freezes solid. And New York, which has been talking about having a bridge for about 70 years, grinds to a halt. And so everyone is desperately in need of, finally got to make this bridge thing happen. And John just, by chance, opens the longest suspension bridge in the world in Cincinnati 3 weeks earlier. So it's incredibly fortuitous timing. I mean, the Cincinnati Bridge is a complete triumph, and he then almost walks into one of the foremost engineering contracts of the 19th century.
So I forget whether it was your commentary or his, but on the top of the two stanchions in Cincinnati are these little gold domes with a cross on the top of it.
Yeah.
Was it you that had second thoughts about it, or did he have second thoughts about how he decorated it?
I do. I have a section in the book where I'm interested in talking about him as a sort of designer and how his design sensibility progresses throughout his career. And I think it's probably right to say that almost everyone regards the Brooklyn Bridges as a design triumph, as the work of not just a great engineer, but a great artist. And John designs bridges, and I think it's probably true to say they get better and more effective as designs as they go on, that they become better engineering, but they also become greater sort of art forms. And a number of other people might agree with me. I think his best statement on his sort of design principles are in the final report he wrote for the Covington and Cincinnati Bridge. But I wonder what those domes are doing up there. They're a sort of Moorish design, and the rest of the bridge is a sort of Romanesque, which is a more medieval design with the buttresses and the arch and things. So they do not belong in the same design genre. I mean, it's a matter of taste on some level, but they seem a bit incongruous to me.
So what would you think about the blue paint and the lights?
Well, the blue paint is new, and certainly it was not painted blue when it was opened. I don't know that John would have painted it blue. And certainly other people have said, I think there's one of your local historians said that if John saw it, he'd die. It was apparently painted blue in 76 to commemorate the 200-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And it has stayed that way. It's interesting how that bridge has evolved. If I have a pet peeve about it, is that it's sort of changed its name, or its name's been officially changed. It was known as the Covington and Cincinnati Bridge, and that sort of gave Covington, I think, a real sense of almost ownership or part ownership in the bridge. The bridge was much more important to Covington than to Cincinnati. And certainly the main mover and shaker behind the scenes, Amos Schenkel, was a Covington guy. His house is still there. I think it's a bed and breakfast. And he was the guy who sort of really got the bridge project back up and running, raised the money for it, rewrote some of the legislation. And it was really important to Covington. And it was important to Cincinnati, but less so. Covington really wanted a piece of Cincinnati. And it was important for Cincinnati to have an overland route to Kentucky as well. But renaming it the John A. Roebling Suspension Bridge takes away the Covington element to it. So that is sort of just one of the many things that have changed about the bridge since it was opened. There's a lot of structural changes about it as well. It's been substantially rebuilt in sections. It only had two suspension cables when it was opened. It's now got four. A lot of the anchorages ridges were redug by Willem Hildebrand in 1895, I think. So there's been a lot of changes to it. It is not necessarily the bridge that was opened in 1867.
But if we could talk to him today, 150 years later or more, and both of those bridges are still carrying the modern traffic load that they do today, would he be surprised? Would he be pleased? Would he be, how would he feel?
I think he'd be tremendously pleased and proud. He was an engineer in a time when things were changing rapidly, and none of this stuff was sort of fixed. I think we just know so much more about engineering than we did in his era, and I think he probably knew that. That things were changing and new things would be discovered. So many of his bridges were taken down eventually because things just got too heavy for them. So the Niagara Bridge was built for 35-ton railroad trains, but then by the turn of the century, railroad trains like 100 tons fully loaded. And a bridge built for 35-ton trains just can't handle trains that are three or four times that weight. So I think he knew that the world was really in flux and that engineering was still being worked out and that people who came after him would perhaps do a better job than him. And that very few things that were built in his lifetime lasted too long, even though we think of the 19th century as a hugely important era in engineering. And he died in 1869. And so I think if he thought that the Brooklyn Bridge and the Covington-Cincinnati Bridge were still around in 2020, I think he'd be tremendously proud.
One of the things that we refer to that bridge as the singing bridge because of the distinctive sound it makes when cars drive over that metal floor.
Yeah.
Did you get to experience that?
I did. I love Roebling's bridges. I love the way they're built. I believe that sound is created by the intricate web of cables. Roebling's bridges are quite unique in that they have the sort of main suspension cables, but then the incline stays as well. So you have that sort of web creation. And both, certainly, the only two bridges that are still, well, Aqueduct Bridge over the Delaware that's still in existence. She's actually the oldest suspension bridge in the world now. But his two sort of bigger suspension bridges that had these cable structures, what also I think is really impressive about them is what it's like for a pedestrian to walk down them. I came out to Cincinnati several years ago, and I stayed for 3 or 4 weeks doing research at the Public Library and the Cincinnati Historical Society. And I walked across a bridge a whole bunch of times, and it's a real joy to be on that bridge. The contrast between the roadway and the granite towers is tremendous. And those towers are beautiful, as they are with the Brooklyn Bridge. And that cable structure is really remarkable. And I guess what creates the sort of vibration that creates this so-called singing. But it's just a visual treat to be able to walk on a Roebling Bridge and to experience that cable structure. And that both the Covington and Cincinnati, or John A. Roebling Suspension Bridge, and the Brooklyn Bridge are very walkable. And that's what I really like about them. You do get a sense of the sort of 19th century from them. They're built in the 19th century for 19th century traffic. Cars are still 40 years away by the time the Covington and Cincinnati Bridge is built.
We used to do an event out here called Tall Stacks, in which they'd invite in steamboats or replica steamboats and have a convention of them and do rides up and down the river. And you could actually walk out on the suspension bridge and look down at all the river boats. It was a real turn back the clock moment that the city used to do.
I love the 19th century. I think the 19th century is a fascinating century. I love almost all parts of it that still remain. Because I think there is a real ability to glimpse what the 19th century might have felt like through their scale, through their engineering. And I think that our rivers are really important, but you only really get a sense of how important, how riverbound New York is by going on the Brooklyn Bridge. And I think the same about Covington, Cincinnati. You really get a sense of, when you think about it, how important the Ohio would have been and how big it was and how influential it was to all of those surrounding communities. You're not necessarily going to get that on a pub tour of Over the Rhine, but you might get that walking over the bridge, and you get a real sense of the importance of the place.
Richard, it's been a delight talking about Cincinnati's favorite bridge tonight with you.
Thank you, John. It's been great to be here.
And I want listeners to know that there's so much more in your Roebling book that we didn't talk about. The bridges in Niagara Falls and Pittsburgh, the aqueducts, his experiences with seances, and his belief in the healing power of water, which cost him his life, actually, before the Brooklyn Bridge was built.
He was a strange man, John Roebling, but also a very interesting one. Just to finish, I think that one thing I really learned by researching this book was what a great lens Roebling was on Cincinnati history. And what a really important and fascinating town Cincinnati was in the 19th century. It was a real industrial powerhouse, much like sort of Pittsburgh was, but it was also like people called it the Boston of the West. It was the Athens of the West. More books were published in Cincinnati than anywhere else in the West. It was a real lens into 19th century America, both in terms of its industrial productivity, but also in its sort of intellectual life and the way in which issues of race and slavery and freedom played out in the city. It's a really fascinating 19th century, well, it's a really fascinating town, but it's really fascinating in the 19th century. And John and his work there and his time there is a real interesting lens into all the really fascinating parts of Cincinnati history, I think.
I've been speaking with Richard Haw, author of Engineering America, A Life and Times of John A. Roebling by Oxford University Press. You can get more information about his book at our website, wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm John Keesmaier.